I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 173 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. If you'd like to support this podcast, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week has a nickname, the Tone Poet. And if you recognize it, you're probably pretty excited that you're about to hear from Joe Harley. Harley produces Blue Note's justly acclaimed Tone Poet series of jazz audiophile vinyl reissues. Harley picks the titles, oversees the top-notch packaging, and he and Ace Mastering Engineer Kevin Gray, a regular Caro Pop guest, prepare each release. When I spoke with Blue Note President Don Was last year about how he improved his label's re-releases, he said he took note of the outstanding quality of the Music Masters reissues of Blue Note albums and hired the guy who put them together. That was Joe Harley. Harley grew up in Nebraska, played drums, and had his life changed when he came across a jazz album boasting a drummer with a very cool name. Later on, Harley soldered and sold cables for a company called AudioQuest, which also started a record label. He became obsessed with the presentation of albums, the engineering in studio, the production, the mastering, the pressing plant, all of it. Now Harley oversees top quality releases of jazz albums he fell in love with decades earlier. There are two Tone Poet releases each month, plus extras for those who sign up for the new Tone Poet Society subscription service. The series covers albums originally on Blue Note, as well as other labels such as Pacific Jazz, United Artists, and Capitol. Releases this year have included albums from Andrew Hill, The Jazz Crusaders, Dizzy Reese, Horace Parlin, Hank Mobley, and Curtis Amy and Frank Butler. What criteria does Harley use in choosing the Tone Poet albums as opposed to those that appear in Blue Note's classic vinyl series? How do he and Kevin Gray work together? How far in advance do they prepare these masters? Is the mastering process different now that more listeners have high-end audio systems than when the albums first were released? How are he and Gray able to evoke such a three-dimensional soundstage out of some of these recordings? When Harley owns an original and a Tone Poet cut of an album, which is he more likely to listen to at home? Have any Tone Poet releases surprised him by how quickly or slowly they sold? How did he get the nickname Tone Poet? Does he still get excited the first time he hears an original master tape of one of these classic recordings? Joe Harley is one of those fortunate people who's doing what he loves, and his enthusiasm and knowledge burst out here. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Joe Harley. Do you get sent a copy of every album that you work on?
Yes. Yeah.
So that in itself will add up over the years because you work on a lot of albums.
Yeah. In anticipation of this interview, I was thinking, gosh, you might ask me how many records have you worked on? And it kind of occurred to me, I don't know. I know it's in the hundreds, but I don't have an exact number.
It was not in my question list, but I figured, because Tone Poet alone, what is it that like two every 2 months or two every month? I was just printing out this year's schedule. So it's like, yeah,
it looks every month.
Yeah. So it's like 24 for the year. So, you know, if you've been doing
and then on top of that, there's usually a box set or two every year. And then there's, In this subscription thing that we have called Tone Poets, there's four exclusives. So it's a lot of records.
How involved are you in the planning of, you know, these are going to be the Tone Poets. This is going to be this club we're going to start. This is going to be what we're going to, you know, what Kevin Gray is going to work on in classic vinyl series that is not as high end as Tone Poet. Like, what's your role in all of that?
So on the Tone Poet side of things, you know, as far as what the titles are, from beginning to end, when I say beginning to end, like planning, what are they going to be? When are they coming out? The artwork, what are the photos going to be? Or if we're having essays like we do in the non-Blue Note titles from Pacific and United Artists and different labels. That's me. I do that. Now I don't lay out the artwork. We have people, but you know, the what are the photos going to be, picking the photos, sourcing them, all of that kind of stuff is left to me. Because, you know, at Blue Note, there aren't that many people. And everybody is really, really busy. Hmm. Nobody has time to be deeply involved in this because they got their hands full with Frontline, you know, which it's a big roster of artists and there's releases coming out all year long. So everyone's got lots to do. I do coordinate with Jem Kurzman, who's head of publicity, but he also runs the classic
right
part. And so we coordinate all the time. I mean, we're great friends and we talk not every night, but frequently in the evenings, not about work, but about music and about, hey man, did you hear this? You know, hey, I pulled this one out the other day. Did you, you know, have you checked that out recently? It's that kind of stuff. And so we coordinate. There's times that he's like, he always defers. He always says, if you want it, it's yours. But a lot of the titles that he puts out in the classic, not all, but you know, a fair number are things that I did at Music Matters with Ron Romba. You know, back in, we started in 2007. And I don't want to just redo those because I, you know, it's like, what would I do? Pick the same photos? I mean, it'd be like, there's so many other titles yet to be done, especially when you consider that the basket of labels is so much bigger. You know, we're drawing from Capitol now and we're drawing from Pacific and United Artists and there's an Art Pepper coming on Intro, a little label called Intro. Hmm. There's a lot of labels under the Blue Note umbrella. So there's so much yet to be done. Tons yet to be done.
So basically, you for Tone Poet, you get first dibs. But you also tend to, the releases tend to be a little more, I don't know if eclectic's the right word, but... Sure. Like kind of like your, you know, your classic Blue Note, right? Your, you know, the album that's on your list of, you know, 1,000 albums to get before you die. Like that album's maybe more likely to be on classic vinyl because, you know, you'll have, you know, the early Herbie Hancock album or Dexter Gordon or whatever. And yours a little more off the beaten path. Is that fair to say? I mean,
sometimes, you know, sometimes it all depends. I mean, you know, Blue Train is
on. I was going to say. Is
poet. This Sonny Rollins at the Vanguard that we did recently, some months back. That's a pretty notable record. But basically, it comes down to not wanting to redo the ones we did at Music Matters. And at Music Matters, we did most of those, you know, the more famous records.
Right.
And I just didn't want to do that all over again.
Even though those editions would be hard to find and expensive, I assume, if you did.
True, but you know, the beauty of it is they're coming out in the classic series and it's mastered by Kevin Gray and they're so you can get terrific sounding versions of those. They're not gatefold, but you can get the music and it's what's the retail? I should know these things. $25 or something like that.
Yeah, as someone who cares more about the record than the cover, I mean, I like the covers and everything, but I've been getting much more up to speed on a lot of these classic Blue Note recordings and also kind of taking deeper dives in some of it. So I've gotten like some of the Tone Poets with like Donald Byrd, for instance, to the extent that when I bought Kofi last year, I noticed it was a different cover. So... Is that your call to change the cover on Kofi?
On Kofi, it was. And the reason I did is that if you look at the original cover, the perspective, like, well, first of all, he has gigantic fingers. Like, they're enormous fingers because of the perspective that the photographer used. And those all came from one session. It's hard to find. Actually, it was hard to find photos of Donald Byrd that are period correct for Kofi. There's only one session. And as you probably can tell, that's just another photo that I used from the same session that doesn't have quite the gigantically inflated fingers that are on the original. So yeah, I took some artistic license there.
So aside from not wanting to repeat stuff that Music Matters did, is there a certain, what is the criteria for what you're choosing for these? Are these kind of like albums that you go back to and you think, wow, that was like an amazing record that people don't know about and they should, and it really deserves this treatment?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. I'm a hopeless list maker. I always have been. And so I've had lists going back to when we started the Music Matters program, and just listening to everything and hearing things and like, oh, we got to do this. We got to do that. And writing it down. And I'll have funny notes to myself, you know, like swearing at myself, like, you better do this, you a-hole, you know? Huh. And so now the thing is huge, you know, because this is what I, every night I go, you know, diving into what else is there, or I look at my list and I think, gosh, I haven't, you know, I my note says we have to do this, but I haven't pulled it out. You know, this note is from 5 years ago. And so I reacquaint myself with it, and inevitably those things end up on a release list somewhere. And like I say, it's big, it's large.
Well, the way Kevin Gray talks about it, you guys work pretty far ahead and are pretty organized.
We do. I'll be in with him at the end of this month. And those titles are for 2028.
Really?
So, yeah, we're way ahead.
So what are all the titles for like 2026 and 27 coming up?
When are they coming out?
No, what are all the titles? I'm just asking you that. You're not going to
nice
answer. Try. I just thought I'd catch you off guard there.
I have them.
I'm sure you do. So how does that work when you so you go in with Kevin Gray and you work on these together? You go to his studio, Coherent Mastering.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Where I've been, and obviously he's made all his own equipment. It's an amazing room.
Yeah.
How does it work? Like, how do the two of you do this? Like, do you bring in an original copy of whatever album you're doing and
frequently
listen to together and, you know, agree on things? Does he handle kind of one part of it and you handle another part? How does it work?
So the way it happens, I do tend to bring the originals, not so much to do what you're saying. You know, we don't play the record and then go from there. But we might refer to it to see if we run into some issue or if there's something that's particularly out of balance, which doesn't come up that much on the Rudy Van Gelder records. It can come up in some of the others. And so I'll bring it just to see, like, if you have a master tape and it's like, wow, this thing is really bright. Then I'll put up the LP. This, okay, how did they must have heard the same thing. And you know what? A lot of times you put up the LP and the LP is really bright.
Mm.
And so that's when you, there's many ways to deal with that. With EQ, well, first of all, when you put up the master tape, frequently it's not that way. Occasionally, but frequently it's not. I've talked about this extensively, but in those days when these things came out, 50s and 60s, they didn't tend to put a lot of low end on records. It wasn't just Rudy who did that.
Right.
Some of the other engineers did too. Because they didn't, you know, they didn't want those records coming back because the customer says it's skipping.
Right. And it's skipping. The needle's going to jump on the bass or something.
Right. So, you know, there was a tendency to really play it safe. And again, you have to put yourself back in that time, but you got to set the bar pretty low. You know, the number of people with really great turntables was a tiny percentage of the buying public. Most people had pretty pedestrian and less than that we would consider now turntables. In fact, some practically on the level of kiddie tables, you know. So yeah, they made a lot of compromises. I totally understand why Rudy, you know, later in life didn't like LP at all. I get it. I can look at his mastering notes and it's like, well, yeah, look what he had to do, you know, to keep at that time. Now, if he were around now, wish he was, and knew what the majority of the people buying these records, that they have a much higher standard of playback and turntable, you know, doesn't even mean they have expensive turntables, but just the standard is so much higher. He wouldn't have to make those compromises. And so I assume he would cut more what you hear on the master tape without having to do that stuff. He's not around, unfortunately, and that's the approach we take. I got totally fascinated first time we put up a master, which was that first session. This is at Music Matters, was Art Blakey, The Big Beat, and Horace Parlin, Speaking My Piece. I knew those records inside out, backwards, forwards, or I thought I did. And then we put the tapes up, and I was just stunned. I was like, I don't know these records. There's so much more information here that I didn't know about. And it's compelling. You know, it's like you're there in the studio. You're there with those guys.
Right.
And so the idea of trying to replicate what the old records sound like went out the window that day and never has returned.
Well, and also the equipment you're using, whether it's what you were using on Music Matters or, I mean, when you're working with Kevin at Coherent,
yeah,
he's probably able to pull a lot more information off of that master than whatever equipment was being used in like 1958 or something like that, right?
Yeah, this is true. You know, cutting systems have improved. The electronics that he has, which are, as you know, they're all custom, are so much more wideband and resolved than what was being used in those days. Although, hey, I like the vintage stuff too. You know, it's a different vibe, and it depending on what you're playing back on, it can be totally cool. I get that.
Right.
But yeah, you have to take a stand somewhere. You have to, you know, you can either say I'm vintage all the way. That's me, man. And I want the records. You can do that, or you can say I want people to be able to hear what these master tapes sound like. And that's the approach we went for.
Right. I mean, basically, obviously there's something very cool about having, if you can get a pristine, you know, OG, you know, copy, yeah, of one of these albums, that's amazing. But if you want it for the pure listening experience, is the Tone Poet going to sound better than that copy?
Well, yeah, that's a loaded question, but I'll tell you what I think. And I'm speaking from the standpoint of having a wall of, I have tons of originals and I like them. It's funny, but once we do it, I'll play, when I get the test pressing, I'll do that comparison frequently just because I just want to hear it, you know? Right. And when you get the test is when the rubber meets the road. It's like, did we nail this or do we have more work to do? And so I'll make that comparison. And, you know, I can't think of a time when I thought, yeah, we did the best we could. I'm sticking with the OG. What I do is, because I'm running out of room, I'll take the OG. After I do that, I'll file it away carefully in the garage. And why don't I sell them? That's a great question. There's no rational answer other than nostalgia.
They're your friends. They're your record friends. You like having them around.
Yeah. I didn't buy them used. I bought them new. I've had them my entire life. And so I put them away and probably, you know, but that point hasn't come yet.
Are these master tapes all in good shape? I mean, they must be if you're getting that much information off of them.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of misunderstanding, or I read things online where people are, it has to do with the tape formulation. So all through the 50s and halfway through the 60s, up till about 63 or so, Rudy was using Scotch 111, and which is incredibly tough. That stuff just, I mean, it sounds, we put them up, it sounds like they were recorded yesterday. I mean, we joke that there's, God knows what's in that stuff. They changed formulations because you couldn't use that stuff anymore. We joke that there's like whale oil or something. You know, there's, right. I don't know what they did, but that stuff is tough. And you don't have to bake, you can't bake it. It's, they're acetate based, so you can't bake those tapes. It's later. It's in, 66 and on that things start to get dicey again because the tape formulations had to change by regulation. And so they get more prone to shedding and they get, and you have to bake them. And there you can get, you can run into more issues. Well, you know, when you bake them and they play great, they sound great. But they're not as tough as the old stuff.
Have you had any where you wanted to do them for Tone Bowett and the tape just wasn't there? I mean, like it wasn't in the shape that you could do it.
Yeah. Yes. That happened. There's a Grant Green title called Oleo that was Sonny Clark and Lewis Hayes. And a thing just wouldn't play. And it was embarrassing because in the tape box, you know, we're like, damn, this thing, it won't even move. You know, it's so sticky, it won't even move. Mm. And then I'm looking in the tape box and I find my own note from when we had tried probably in 2007 or 8 at Music Matters and I'd forgotten about it. And there's my own note, you know, tape won't play. I just had forgotten. That's about the only time I think we ran into that. There's very few instances in with Blue Note of tapes being missing, but there's a few. I've talked about it so people know about this, but Duke Pearson, Sweet Honey Bee, that tape's been missing for ages. I have no idea what happened to it, but you know, if you hear it now, that comes from a needle drop. But yeah, so I always tell people, if you have an OG of that one, cherish it.
Hold on to that one. Are there like high quality copies of any of these missing ones in terms of either a sort of analog 1-to-1 or, you know, your very high end digital whatever?
In that particular case, I'd say no, because what they have came from that needle drop some years ago.
Okay.
So, not that someone couldn't put that out. I don't personally want to do that. But somebody could.
So to go back to Rudy Van Gelder, you know, your legendary Blue Note and other labels, prestige engineer. If you hear a recording that he did, can you tell that he did it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Absolutely.
What is it about what he did that you could tell?
The way he mics things. So comparing to other engineers of that time, you know, Roy Dunan at Contemporary, some of the others in New York, in a stereo context, he always laid things out the same way, you know, drums are on the right. If he had, if it was a quartet with a tenor player, tenor is going to be on the left. If it's a quintet with a trumpet, you know, it's going to be trumpet on one side, sax on the other. I mean, he was very, very, very consistent in the way he approached things. But more than that, it's the sonic perspective. It's the tonality. You know, he came in pretty close. Rudy didn't like Tape Hiss. Not that anyone likes Tape Hiss, but,
right.
you know, in those days, the headroom on, they were dealing with much more limited headroom than we are now. So, I mean, it's kind of amazing. Here they are going live to two track. And, you know, your margin for error is like really small. Your headroom isn't that much. And so, and you got a guy that doesn't want Tape Hiss. So he hits that tape hot. Consequently, you hear more instances of overload on his stuff than you would with some of the other engineers, you know, like Roy Dunant. To me, it doesn't bother me. You know the context. You know he's working live. He's mixing live. And so, you know, sure, somebody comes in hot, the tape saturates, overloads, and you hear him, you know, you hear that fader coming down quick. Sometimes modern users are like, why couldn't you and Kevin fix that? Well, because it's there.
Right. Your job is not to remix.
Well, we can't. There's nothing to remix. You have a live to two track tape. Right. There is no mix. And so, to me, personally, I listen to that, and it not that I want that all over the place, although some Art Blakeys do have that all over the place, some of them, because Art would just bash the crap out of everything. And so there's a fair amount of that. But to me, it adds to the excitement of that's what happened that day. And Rudy's a part of the performance too. You know, he's in some cases hanging on for dear life. It does. It's just there. It's part of that history. It doesn't bother me.
There are mistakes on almost every Beatles record, mistakes in quotes. And it just doesn't matter. You know, something that someone would fix electronically now that at the time was like, no, it's whatever. It's the Beatles.
100%. 100%. That's a great way of looking at it. And I look at it the same way. That's what happened that day. And, you know, and it's on the tape and that's what we have.
This is a listener 101 question, but sometimes I'll put on one of these, you know, these Tone Poets and, you know, I'll just kind of crank it up. And part of what really gets me is that kind of three-dimensional presentation where I'll really feel like the drums are over here and the yeah. horn is over here or whatever else. You know, and sometimes you'll put on an album and it seems kind of flat. And sometimes you'll put on an album and the musicians are like in different parts of your room. How do you do that?
That's a great question, and there is an answer. The answer to that is that those dynamics are on the master tape, but a lot of times in mastering, people would use compression. And so compression flattens things out. It also makes things play louder. So
right.
when people are comparing their OGs, I always tell them you have to adjust for the level because the OG, because Rudy did put compression on, is always going to play louder. You add more compression, it's like commercials. Why are they have laws against it now, but in the old days, commercials played loud. They weren't louder. They were more compressed. And so, when you make the comparison, you have to adjust your volume to account for that. But adding the compression is what flattens that out. And what you're referring to is like, we never use that. We never use compression. In fact, Kevin's, his compressor, there's one on the board, but for two or three years, the thing was broken. And since he never used it, he never fixed it.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if it's fixed to this day, actually. I'm not sure.
I'll have to ask him.
Yeah.
When you and Kevin are working on this stuff, are you always on the same page? Is there any kind of difference in aesthetic between the two of you, or sometimes you have to hash something out because you'll want to tend to go in one direction and he'll tend to want to do something else?
No. We joke with each other that we're like an old married couple at this point. In fact, when people, if there's ever people that come in we talk more, because when we're there by ourselves, we've done so many hundreds and hundreds of records together that we'll hear something, and it's like it'd be extremely unusual that we don't both hear something at the same time. And he'd look at me, and I would nod, and he know, like, we don't even use words anymore. I know when we've heard something, he's like, "You good with that?" I'm like, "Yeah." And then he'll go make the adjustment. Now, the adjustment might be that he put in a bump at 60 or something, like a 1 dB bump. Or if something's really coming across super bright, we both know it. We'll like look at each other like, "Whoa," and there's many ways to deal with that. You can reduce the top end. You can also add some low end, which has the effect of pulling your attention down, and you don't perceive the piercing brightness. That gets tamed without actually reducing.
The balance of it's different.
The balance of it is different. It's interesting the way psychoacoustics works, but I honestly, it would stick large in my mind if we'd ever like, "Hey, I want to do this." No, I don't want to do that.
There you go again. Wanted to do that thing that I hate.
There you go. And we need to get a divorce. It would loom large in my mind. That's never happened.
And the two of you also must have extraordinary ears, because you're both looking at each other like, "Wait, there is a 1 decibel difference just there," and I don't know whether that just comes from years of training your ears and also maybe not listening to stuff too loud, or is there any secret to maintaining those ears?
Well, if you go to loud concerts, wear hearing protection.
I have since my 20s.
Yeah, good. Good.
Probably should have started earlier, but still.
Same here. I mean, I played drums as a kid, and I'm sure that did some work. But no, and his monitoring system, you've been there, so his monitoring system is just stellar. Like, I tell people, like, if an ant farted in the studio, you can hear it. If it's on that tape, you can hear everything. And so it makes it much easier to do the job when you can hear everything. Interestingly, it presents very much like what Kevin's does. Tonally, it's almost identical. And so it makes it great, because even though the brands are different, his is all custom. When I get a test pressing here, it's like I'm at Kevin's. And so it's very easy to be on the same page. Well, and we know this translates, that if it sounds right in his place and my place, it's going to translate to most people, not all people. We can't control, someone has, a speaker where a driver's gone out and they don't know. We can't control things like this. But you're aiming to hit the center for most people, most listeners with reasonable systems.
So to work backwards a little bit, I talked with Don Was for this podcast a few months ago, and he talked about how he was getting grief for the 75th anniversary reissues and was listening to the Music Matters and was still blown away by those. He's like, "Well, that's what we need. We need to do this." And he says that that's how he contacted you originally. Was that the first you'd cross paths with him, or did you know him already at that point?
You know what? In the 90s, when we had a label at AudioQuest Music, that we had for a number of years, and I used a studio then known as Ocean Way in LA frequently. And it was amazing the number of times we'd be in Studio A and he'd be in Studio B. In fact, I remember doing something, I think in A, when he was in there with Bonnie Raitt doing Nick of Time.
Okay.
And so peripherally knew each, it's like, "Hey man, But we didn't really, you know, I was working on a Charles Lloyd record for Blue Note, and Don came to it, and it was at that session that was at East West that he pulled me aside, and that's when he made the pitch for, like, why don't you come do this for us? And that was in early summer, I think, of 2018, or maybe spring of 2018. And then I started in August of 2018. And the first releases came out in early 2019, January or February 2019.
Was that before or after Charles Lloyd had nicknamed you the Tone Poet?
That goes back to... we started working together in the late 90s, and he started that pretty early on. We did a record, a great record. People should all check this out. It's called Water is Wide. And Billy Higgins was on that record. What a thrill to, you know, it was towards the end of his life, but he sounded fantastic. He sounded amazing. And what a band. Brad Meldow, Larry Grenadier, John Abercrombie. I mean, I'm looking out the control room window just going, damn, how great is this?
And you're producing this record or engineering or both?
No, Mike Ross engineered, I would say, no, Charles and his wife, Dorothy, actually Manfred Eicher might've been listed, or it might've been Charles and Dorothy. Manfred didn't like, and doesn't like, as far as probably still doesn't like, sunlight. And so LA was like, you know, he didn't like LA. So that was when Manfred stopped working on those, and Charles was recording in LA. So I was doing most of those ones that were done in all of them, actually, for ECM at that time. But the credit, I'd have to go look, but the credit at one point said Tone Poet. Didn't say produce, didn't just said Tone Poet. And he would say that to me, he called me that. So I was like, yeah, okay, cool.
Was that because he thought you had such great ears or great touch with his music?
Maybe.
I mean, it's a great name.
Don heard him say that, and so, you know, Don picked right up on it. He was like, "What did he call you?" And I said, "Oh, you know, he calls me Tone Poet." And so we hadn't named the series yet, but Don remembered that, and to him, it was obvious we should call the series Tone Poet.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's classic Anti-Hero is the number one selling IPA in Illinois. It combines five classic U.S. hop varieties with bold citrus, floral, and pine aromas. And as the weather warms up, cold time sure hits the spot. This premium lager is an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. The brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. So you grew up in Nebraska. Did you originally think, I want to be a performer, and then move on to the recording side and the engineering and the technical? And I know you were also involved in actual audio equipment with AudioQuest. Yeah. So what's like, what led to what in that respect?
Well, as a kid, I started playing drums. I think when I was 8 or 9 years old, something like that. I had a set of drums, and, you know, good drums and Zildjian cymbals and all that. and would kind of veer back and forth between, you know, the Beatles had happened. Let me think here, when I was 13. But before that, I had picked up this record by Sonny Clark. And what that record, what a Blue Note record was doing at Waltz Music in Lincoln, Nebraska, that's a great, I mean, I don't know, but it was there. And I bought it. And
had you heard something from it, or did you just think, oh, this looks cool, I'm going to pick up this random Blue Note jazz record?
Well, I looked, first of all, the cover had legs on it, and women's legs. And so, you know, I was too young to probably know why that was fascinating, but for some reason it was fascinating to me. But I turned it over, and I saw the drummer. The drummer's name was Philly, in quotes, Philly Joe Jones. And I thought, that's so cool. That guy must be the coolest dude. I mean, maybe someday I could be Lincoln Joe Harley, you know? And I had to, you know, that doesn't sound quite so cool. And then look at the picture back here. He really looks cool. And I'm just a little kid. But so I can't tell you, no, man, I knew that music was going to just speak to me. Nothing to do with that. I mean, to be totally honest, it was just those two things, legs and Philly Joe Jones.
Right. But then the music then did speak to you, and he's a pretty damn good drummer too. So.
Yeah. Well, and then I get it home, and you know, my mother had, we had records around the house, but they tended to be, you know, My Fair Lady and things like that. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but I put this thing on, and boy, I sat right up. I was like, the groove and what he was playing, it just, I'd never heard anything like it. It just blew me away. And so naturally, what do? You know, you turn it up and you start to try to play along. And, you know, I realized pretty quick, damn. I mean, I was taking drum lessons and was considered a little prodigy at that point in Lincoln, Nebraska. But that was really humbling. I was like, oh my God, what are they? You know, they're not just going thump, 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 thump. You know, this is all coming from the ride cymbal. Like, what's going on here? And so the hook was set, right? And it just led to, you know, more and more and more.
Were you trying to emulate any drummers when you were drumming before this?
The Ventures and, you know, there was surf music and the Beatles came on the scene. And, you know, so that was sort of the dilemma, you know, like my heart was in this one thing, but all my friends were into this other thing. So I tried to do both. And needless to say, it was a little easier to kind of fake my way through it on the rock side than the jazz side. That was right. Humbling.
I mean, were you doing the Wipeout drum solo?
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Yeah, sure.
So when did you start, you know, getting into the recording side of it?
Well, I had, we had moved to first Milwaukee, but then New York. And which was fantastic because, boy, you know, my dad's job took him to New York. And so that was spectacular because for a little jazz fan, it's like now I'm in the city. And so I knew, I started to know musicians. And in fact, one of my dear friends, still dear friend from Lincoln, is a drummer named Victor Lewis. He's actually from Omaha, but he was in school in Lincoln. And so that was sort of how I got in those circles. And I started hanging out at the club, started hanging out at Slugs was like my go-to, my home away from home. It was cheaper to get in there than the Vanguard. And it was considered more, at that time, more out, you know. And it was also had a vibe of danger, which, you know, as a little teenager, I thought, oh, this is cool. I'm not quite sure what these dudes are into, but but it's dangerous. And so, you know, I would hang out. And then I started to go to, we moved to LA. By this time I was on my own. And I started to go to some sessions. And just as an observer, you know, I would find myself at different sessions, including some sessions that Victor Lewis was on. That's probably how I got in the door. And then at AudioQuest in the, like starting, I think around 89 or 90, we started this AudioQuest Music label. And that's really when, you know, it was like, okay, now you're running the session. And, you know, learning curve was steep and quick.
And with AudioQuest, you'd been like building equipment for them, like making cables?
Well, going way back when there was three of us there. I mean, I was there from the beginning. Yes, I did. Solder. I mean, we all did. There was only three people. I mean, we soldered cables, we shipped and sent out billing. You know, you had to do it all. As time went on, I was more involved in marketing and product development, things like that. But then we had this label, and that became the focus until it was sold. We sold it in 2000, I believe. But there was, you know, I found myself looking out that glass window pretty early on there, looking at Ry Cooder and Jim Keltner and Terry Evans. You know, I didn't want to do like audiophile sound effects records. I wanted to do real music. And so that was a great way to figure out what was going on, get the sound I wanted.
And were there any producers at that point who you were also kind of looking toward, like, this is the kind of thing I want to be doing?
Well, there was, you know, I always looked at credits, and when I'd find something that I thought was presented correctly, I made sure I knew who mastered it, who recorded it, where did they record it, where was, you know, who was the engineer. I think early on, I'd heard this record by Ry Cooder called Paris, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I thought, man, that just sounds amazing.
Right. Great soundtrack.
I like this, you know, and I think the engineer was Mark Ethel, and it was recorded at Ocean Way. And so that's why I started to do sessions at Ocean Way with our label, because, you know, and sure enough, if you went there, if you couldn't make a good sounding record there, you got problems. Then the problem is you, you know.
And you also seems like you figured out early on that the mastering is a key part of it too. Like, I think a lot of producers, I don't know this for a fact, but I don't know that a lot of producers are as focused on the mastering part of it necessarily.
Well, yeah, I mean, the mastering is the last, that's your last chance before you present it to the world to make adjustments. And it's also like a check and balance. Generally, I mean, Rudy was an exception because he was the recording engineer and the mastering engineer. And he did a great job at both, but generally that doesn't happen. The mastering engineer is different than the recording engineer, and it is a check and balance. So if you bring in something and it's a little, what, you know, it's too much in the bass or something, the mastering engineer is going to adjust that. Whatever the problem might be. So, you know, again, looking to who was who in LA at that time, I started using Bernie Grumman, another great friend. And so I worked with him for years and years. We did lots and lots of records together. Great, great mastering engineer.
Right.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And then the pressing plant too, how big of a factor is where you press it?
Huge. It's huge. I mean, presses sound different. That's a huge thing. There's many, many pressing plants. There's not a lot of great pressing plants. So yeah, that's really important. I started an association with Record Technology Inc. out in Camarillo very early on when we had the label AudioQuest. In fact, we did one of the first 180 gram records at that time. They called it HQ180.
But I remember that.
I'd have to go back and look, but it might have been like our fourth record. Maybe they all were RTI. You know what they were? They were all RTI. It was from the jump. It was RTI.
And all the Tone Poets now are as well.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are. Yeah, the whole, there's so much, you know, if you ever visit a pressing plant, I wish everyone would, because they'd be astounded that records are as cheap as they are. When you look at how many steps and how many people handle the lacquer that you send to them and what goes into plating, it's astonishing that somehow the records are as cheap as they are. Even the Tone Poets, you know, at $38, because to do it right, there's a lot of steps involved.
Yeah, Kevin also made it clear that he thinks it's really important how close RTI is, and that there are a lot of, you know, there are companies that'll send their lacquers overseas to get pressed, and he thinks that just the time it takes to get to Europe, to Czechoslovakia, wherever, to get printed, to get pressed, you're losing something from it. Whereas sending it right to RTI, they're just kind of getting it fresh off the...
get it the next morning, and they... You know, Doran out there, who's a brilliant plating guy. When we finish mastering, I'll go back to the hotel and I'll send him an email and tell him, okay, incoming. In fact, they always say, it's what it says, Tone Poet incoming. They're all titled like that. And he knows, like, you're going to get it probably 8 or 9 in the morning. I don't even have to say it. He knows I want it in the bath. You know, right now, like right away. And so they do that.
And then you'll hear a test pressing of it at that point?
No, it gets plated. And once it's metallized and plated, you're good. It's locked. You know, it's locked. Then you're not fighting time anymore. It's that stage between lacquer and getting metallized that you're fighting time. Then I'll usually get a test pressing 3-4 weeks later, something like that. But yeah, once you have it, once the thing has been plated, you could make the record. Then you could make the record in 10 years. The record's locked at that point.
So if there's any issue with the test pressing, does it have to do with the plating, or is it like, do they have to replate it, or is it just something they having to do with the pressing, you know, process or something?
It depends. I always get, minimum two test pressings. And the reason for that, if you hear like a tick or pop, first thing you do, well, I'll sit there with a stopwatch and listen. First, I'll clean the record in an ultrasonic machine, because I want to make sure nothing is on this test pressing. Like, it's clean. Because if there's random junk on there, that's irrelevant. I want to hear what's on this thing.
Right.
And so if you hear a tick or pop, then I'll go to the second pressing, and I've already got a record of where it was on the first. And if the tick and pop is in the exact same spot, now you've got to check the mother or the stamper. And oftentimes they can correct it there. In fact, sometimes just cleaning the stamper corrects it, but that generally they can fix it. If they can't, then you have to recut. Because it could have been something in the lacquer, some defect in the lacquer.
Right.
And if that's the case, you got to recut. And it happens.
How often does that happen? Like 1% of the time, or?
You know, maybe, let me think, maybe 1 out of 20 or something that will, or 1 out of 30 that I'll go, yeah, it's on both copies. It's in the same spot. And, but usually they can fix it. you know, they can fix it and by dealing with the mother or the stamper. If that can't be done, then you recut. So that's actually probably more rare that we actually have to recut for that reason. Usually it gets fixed at the by dealing with the mother and stamper.
There are companies now that will sell the test pressings. Is that a good deal? Should people be buying test pressings, or is that kind of like, you know, and I mean, some of them will, it'll be like $100 for this test pressing. Some of them they'll sort of mark it down, but I'm always like, well, do I want to actually buy a test pressing, or do you want to sort of get the one that's actually, you know, came out okay?
Oh, test pressing. I thought you were referring to lacquers because there are
no, the test pressing. Like, you'll have your white, plain white label and it'll say there's the name of the record.
No, that would be, I mean, like nobody with a conscience would sell a test pressing that later had to be corrected like that. I mean,
you would hope.
I guess you could, but that would be pretty dark to do something like that. So answer, yeah, you could definitely sell a test pressing. I mean, an approved test pressing, sure, why not? I mean, the advantage, I mean, it definitely is the first one off the press, but there's also people that, I haven't done these tests, but I've heard people talk about how the best pressing is probably 50 or so in, because, you know, the stampers, you know, there's a slight break-in. I haven't tested that myself, so I don't know. But no, technically the test pressings will be the first pressings. Yeah.
Do you like the idea of people collecting, you know, the tone poets or other things you've worked on? You know, should there be a sense of these are kind of limited quantity, so grab it? Or is the idea really like, you know, even if we run out, we'll just repress it because we want everyone to have it?
More of the latter. You know, just logistically, sometimes things do go run out, and there's been a few cases because we end up hearing about it, or I'll read about it, where something was out for a year or so and people get understandably cranky. I would too. But usually it has to do with logistics, just because if you're going to press more, you need to print more jackets, and there's many different things in play. But yeah, we don't want these to be to run out.
Yeah, I think that my favorite local record store over here, he'd gotten in, I think it was the new pressing of Chet Baker Sings. And he's like, this has been gone for like 2 years. You know, we just got it in. We have one copy. And I was like, okay, I bought it because I didn't know the album, but then I read stuff about it. I'm like, okay, classic record. Couldn't find it for a long time. Sounds fantastic.
Well, that's an interesting case. You actually can find it, but it's a big but. They don't sound worth, they don't sound very good because there are, they tend to come from the EU. There are these labels that specialize over there in putting out stuff. They're almost all sourced from CDs. And normally we'd use the word bootleg, but they take stuff that's in a particular country out of copyright. And then they'll put those out. And so, yeah, Chet Baker comes to mind because you'll see a cheap Chet Baker Sings. And I've had people go, I don't get it. I don't hear anything pretty. It's like, well, no, you wouldn't, because that thing we had was nowhere near the master tape.
Right.
And basically, you know, presumably it was cut from a CD. So it wasn't even, it was just a transfer. Yes, it's on vinyl, and yes, it's $15 or whatever, but it's not a good presentation of the music.
Yeah, I think that Tone Poet was one where the original Tone Poet had sold out and it was getting resold for a lot on Discogs or wherever, and then I guess you guys were able to repress it and now people can get it on Tone Poet again. So I got whatever the repress, but it's the same, you know, it's the same lacquer.
Same. Yeah. It's all the same.
Have there been any Tone Poets that have surprised you either by how quickly they sold or how not quickly they sold?
Well, some of the, you know, in the Pacific Jazz catalog, they're records I've loved for years, and to me they're all special. But yeah, there's been times. This record, Katanga, by Curtis Amy and Dupree Bolton, I've loved forever, and most people don't know about it. But so, you know, put it in rotation and it came out, and I think we ordered whatever we ordered. I can't remember. And then people started talking everywhere about it. It's like, have you heard this record? And it was gone. I mean, it was gone because people would hear it and go, holy cow, I've never heard of this. Why don't I know this record? And that's fun. Not fun that it sells out and they don't exist, but we had to repress that two or three or four times just because everybody jumped on it. There's one coming next month. This will sound self-serving, I guess, but whatever. I played it last night, so it's on my mind. It's Curtis Amy, Frank Butler, Groovin' Blue, and
Pacific Jazz,
and Curtis Amy's also on Katanga. But it, in my opinion, it's that kind of record. It's like, okay, I don't know this. I don't know that I've ever seen it. I mean, the band is Carmel Jones, Bobby Hutcherson, who's 19. It's his first time, first recorded appearance. Frank Strazzeri and Jimmy Bond, and Frank Butler. And anyway, who knows whether that'll be the same, but quality wise, to my ears, it lives in that same zone. And, but yeah, you never know. You never know.
You still get excited the first time you hear one of these master tapes?
Hell yeah. Every time. Yeah, because you know the record so well. And it's always that shock of, no, you don't. Huh. You know, you thought you did, but you actually don't. That's fun. It's really fun.
There is something about that sense of music, sounding like musicians are in a room when they recorded something 60 years ago. And You're like, how could this sound so present and alive, and again, filling the room, you know, with that soundstage and everything else when it's like from, you know, the year I was born or before I was born or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just kind of magical. There's just something about it that that totally hooks me and has gotten me much more into these albums, you know, just in part because you just feel like you're being transported.
No, you hit it. That's it. Same here. Like when everything is working right, when the music is just killing and the sound is great. And again, from this time, you're not dealing with all the compression. And so the dynamics are real. What happens? You know, you're kind of getting in a time machine. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you can picture, hey man, I'm there and there are the cats, man, they're playing and they're playing right in front of me. It doesn't get much better than that.
I saw a quote from you where you said, Don Was once told me, never let them see you sweat. In other words, stay cool and focused. That was great advice. When did that advice come in most handy?
He's referring specifically to when you're producing live sessions with as opposed to doing catalog stuff. So what he means, and he's 100% right. Don's 100% right about most things, I have to say. He's a remarkable guy. You know, you've talked to him, so he's amazing. Like, if you're having, in the control room, you're having some technical issue or something, like, that's, you need to deal with that. You don't need to lay that on the musicians. Like, their job is to the conditions to be the best for them to create. And they shouldn't have to be bogged down with technical stuff that you're dealing with. And he's totally right about that. And if you're, you know, maybe you're racing around because you're, you know, it's like, we got to get a new, this microphone, you know, it's crapping out. We need to get a new one. Or the mic pre is not working. We got to go in. Like, when you go back out to talk to the guys, you don't need to bring all that with you. You go back into the music and you want to keep things positive and moving and all of that. That's kind of what he's referring to. And when you're in live sessions, he's 100% right.
So can you think of an instance where that was tested the most for you?
Yeah, but I'm going to keep that one to myself, I think.
All right, we'll save that one for part two. The next time we check in with you, we'll try to wear you down on those secrets. Thank you so much for all this. Actually, I'm going to ask you one more thing, and then I'm going to let you go. Just in terms of about the Tone Poet Club. So if you sign up for this club, you get there what, four titles that you wouldn't be able to buy otherwise? Like, how does that work? And what's just sort of the economics of a club right now? Because it seems like there are a lot more, like Verve just has one, had started one. Final Me Please, I've been in that one, although they're kind of going through some changes. Like, tell me about the club thinking for Tone Poet.
Well, so this came up, the idea came up last year. Yeah, I didn't know quite what to expect with it, but I didn't cook up the idea, but I related to it. I thought, well, this would be kind of cool. We can, you know, like I can communicate with people in a way that's a little different than I do on Facebook or Instagram or whatever. And then they have early access. They get the titles before anybody else. And then there's different tiers with increasing levels of discounts, depending on what tier you're in. And then you have access to these exclusives. So that's like the only part of what we're doing that is exclusive. They are limited to 1,000 copies, and there's four a year. And first one is out, and we're announcing the second one very shortly. There was a lot of, initially everyone, this was for the US, and we couldn't do it for other countries at first because of, a lot of stupid logistic stuff with, differing shipping costs in each country and import, duties and stuff that are involved. It's way more complicated than people could imagine. Trust me. However, been very diligent about working through that. First, we were going to wait till we could do the whole world. And then we realized people be waiting a long time, and that's going to make them unhappy.
Right.
This first group covers a lot of key countries that particularly want these. So it's going to cover, a lot of people are going to be happy. But then we'll do a second tier where we get the rest of everybody. It's just, it's hard logistics. You know, you're trying to have one set price, and because trying to have it for each country is, which is, it's too, then you shouldn't even do it, because it's, we don't have the manpower and can't be done. Like, it has to be something that's simple enough to be done. And we're finally there. So I'm happy about that.
Have you had a lot of people sign up for this club?
Yeah. In fact, I just had to sign a pile more of the welcome cards. I'm sitting there with like 750 cards. You know, I did it yesterday. But I'm looking down going, oh my God, you know, I got to sit here and do all these. But Don had already signed his part. We both signed it.
So you're actually both signing them yourself. You're not just stamping them or anything.
No. They're all
total analog signatures.
They're analog signatures. And I looked and I was like, he did it. You know, man, if he sat there and did it, I'm going to sit there and I'm going to do it too. And so that was another group. But yeah, it's going well. And it's fun. The functionality of the site's about to get, is going to have a real jump where people can interact with each other much more easily, where you can actually, I mean, I don't know why this is hard. I'm an analog guy. I don't know how to do these things, but to make it where people can dialogue with each other directly rather than having to me go up there and say, so-and-so asked this question and here's the answer, then I can just go underneath the question and answer.
Right.
Like normal chat group. That's going to happen. A bunch of stuff is about to get done there.
Sounds cool.
And newsletters. The first one's going to be a gigantic newsletter because it's going to cover all months leading up to this. And then it's a newsletter a month. So they're about to be a gigantic newsletter that we'll do. But this one's kind of weird. I didn't come up with this, but it's fine. They can get a phone call with me. It says 15 minutes. I'm not going to go, hey, your time's up. Bye.
How many of these phone calls are you going to have to do?
Oh, no, I think it's limited to like it's a
group call.
Yeah, you could. That possibility we talked, I don't know how it's going to all play out. Initially, it was like a lottery or something, but it said 15 minutes. And I was like, I'm talking to somebody and we're having a good conversation. We'll keep talking. I'm not going to stop it at 15 minutes. But maybe it'll end up being, take some other form. I'm not entirely sure. But the rest of it, people are going to see a lot of additional things. I post frequently. Yesterday I found a picture people hadn't seen before, a great picture of Alfred Lion and Billy Higgins standing in the studio talking. And Billy's got this great big smile because, smiling Billy. And it made me think about the special relationship Alfred Lion had with the musicians. There's many cases of musicians saying it wasn't like other labels, like we had a real relationship. I mean, Horace Silver was dear friends with Alfred Lion for ages. And Sonny Rollins talks about how he treated the guys like with total respect. And anyway, I wrote about that yesterday and posted on there and put a picture up.
Do you think back on like when you were a kid in Nebraska and you're buying your first Blue Note record and seeing Philly Joe Jones's name on there, and now you basically have access to all of it and the master recordings and the photos and the vaults? Like it seems like a dream come true. It's work, but
no, man. It honestly, it's not work. It isn't. I never feel like I work. Although my wife would say, can you give it a rest? Like take a day or something. But it never feels like work. I can't wait to get at it every day. And my least favorite time of the year is the last 2 weeks of December because UMG, all of UMG is off. And it's like, I hate that time because it's like all my playmates are gone, and although I end up, there's other work I can do that I still manage to fill each day. So,
well, thank you so much. This is really great. I'm really glad I got to talk to you. I've been listening to your work for a long time, and Kevin's talked about you every time I've talked with him. And I've had aside from going out to dinner with him and stuff, I've had, I think 4 of these episodes with him. So it's a treat to get to talk to you at last. I look forward to hearing more of these tone poets when I can pick them up too.
Awesome. What a pleasure.
That's it for episode 173 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Joe Harley for taking us inside the Tone Poet series and his own accomplished creative career. Go to store.bluenote.com for information about the Tone Poet Final series and the Tone Poet subscription series. The next 2 Tone Poet releases are Art Pepper's Modern Art and Teddy Edwards' Sunset Eyes on April 4th. Blue Note's It Might As Well Be Spring sale runs through March 23rd and features 20% off music and merch and up to 50% off the Spring Cleaning Collection, with free shipping for orders over $85. Again, go to store.bluenote.com. And you can find Joe Harley on Instagram at JazzSaraswati. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, a AAA master in his own right. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.